What's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd here. Thomas Drance is my co-host. He covers the Canucks at The Athletic as well. We're broadcasting live from the Kintech studio. Kintech Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. This hour of Canucks Talk brought to you by Rack Steel. You need forklifts that perform under pressure and pallet racks, pallet racking that maximizes your space. Visit them online at racksteel.com. What's going on, Drance?
Not much, buddy. How are you?
Good. I got a likely spam phone call in the middle of the Rack Steel read there.
Oh, damn.
Love that. Love those spam phone calls.
I hate those spam
calls. Love getting like five spam phone calls a day. That's awesome.
Yeah, someone's got to do something about that.
We should fix that as a society.
The worst part about it is when you get excited or like, you know, when you get one when you're waiting on a call. And the worst part is like as a reporter, right? Like I'm not always getting calls from numbers that I recognize.
Of course. Yeah.
So it's like I'll be waiting, you know, like, oh, man, once I'm done this interview, my whole afternoon is free. And then I get a call and you answer it and you're like, hello. And then you know how they don't jog when you say hello once.
Yeah,
you have to hello again. And then it's like you hear the click and then it's like, you're about to be arrested and your entire family is too as a result of this thing we took from customs that you ordered off Amazon. The only thing that can save your entire family is your credit card
number. Is saying your social insurance number right now.
I also had a, like, my grandfather once got a call and I was like out being a responsible human being, but I was like young enough that this was conceivable and I lived in the East.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, your grandson's been arrested in Montreal for drunk driving and I'm his lawyer and he needs you to wire him money immediately and blah, 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 blah. And my grandfather like tells the story. He took it very seriously. My grandfather was the best, was like absolutely willing to help me stay out of a Montreal prison. And he went to like, you know, one of those like Western Union style, like money sending things, and he was like going through the paperwork and it's like, if you're old and you are sending money for a relative in trouble who you haven't spoken with, like, be careful. And he was like going through and he's like, every single box applied to me. So I left
all of the red flags for scamming. That's so funny. Well, good for him.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't send money, but my entire family was certain that I'd been in trouble. Like I got home and I checked my answering machine and like my entire family was like, what happened? Why would you call grandpa? And I was like, I absolutely wouldn't.
What the heck is going on?
I don't know what to tell you.
Big Wednesday show as always. We're going to do the crossover here in a couple of minutes with Don Taylor and Rick Dhaliwal. Jason Bukala will join us at one. He is on site at the NHL Draft Combine in Buffalo. So looking forward as always to chatting with Bukala. And of course, it's also a big day. It is game one of the Stanley Cup final tonight in Edmonton. Been a bit of a gap here, waiting for things to get going, but I think we're both very, very excited to see how this series plays out, Drance. We can do more of a in-depth preview later, but
yeah,
I mean,
we'll
just off the top,
we want to
acknowledge it and the excitement of seeing these two teams in a rematch this year.
Yeah, I mean, I fully believe that this could be some of the highest level hockey we've ever seen in the Stanley Cup era, to be totally honest with you. Like, I think we're at that level, or these teams are at that level. And here's one thing I'd like urge you to consider. Like, I think Tampa Bay was a top five team, top six team in the NHL. I think Vegas was a top five team in the NHL. I think Dallas was a top five team in the NHL. I think Carolina was a top five team in the NHL. I think the Leafs were a top 10 team with a really good game plan and high level stars. And I think the LA Kings were probably a top 10 team. That honestly, like, could the LA Kings have defeated Dallas in a 7-game series? Like, I absolutely think they could have.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did most of these teams lose to Edmonton and Florida, I'd say most of them were, like, humbled. These were sunnings.
Yep.
And now we get to see them
play.
They're
clearly the two best teams left, and it's going to be a blast to see them play against each other in the Stanley Cup final again. All right, as mentioned, we got a lot to get into, so let's go to the crossover with Don Taylor and Rick Dhaliwal. They are the co-hosts of Donnie and Dolly on Check TV, which you can watch Monday to Friday, 10 to noon, and they join us as they do every week here on a Wednesday for the crossover. And guys, I got to say, it's a beautiful, sunny day out. It's June, and you guys look like you're getting set for an expedition to the Arctic here. What's going on? You're all bundled up.
Well, Well, as Rick will tell you, we have air conditioning issues in our studio. It's working too well.
It's stuck on right now.
Donnie, Dolly, and Shackleton over here.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Our room, our studio has got no heat, just air conditioning. It's minus 40 in here. My hands are frozen. And that's why I'm wearing a jacket.
Right. The worst part about it is that we had a technician in here yesterday.
Fixed it.
Yeah, he fixed it too well.
Apparently.
Where's our music today, by the way?
We played it. We played it. It just came in late.
Music.
It came in late.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, we played it.
All right.
We got some moving pieces here, all right? It's next man up at Sportsnet 650, but we're doing our best.
Where do you guys want to start? Do you want to start with vague paparazzi photos of Canucks bigwigs at various practice facilities
that your
producers are tagged in?
Unlike Jim Rutherford, they're not wearing shorts today.
Or do you want to start at Derek Forbert, or do you want to start at Kevin Dean? We'll let you guys lead us around the dance floor here.
You go.
So you're saying the photo of the practice facility is fake, Thomas?
No, I said it was paparazzi. It was like an unauthorized photo from a distance.
A clandestine photo.
Yes.
It was from a distance, but I would think most people would suggest that it's positive for the Canucks.
Yeah, it is.
Which doesn't happen all the time these days. It looks like that maybe they're taking a step towards a long-awaited practice facility. Not so sure about the location,
that's
but
big
at
wigs,
least it's
though.
There.
That's, I mean, that's president, GM, president of business operations, and a representative of the Aquilini family. I mean, that's four people with a fair bit of weight internally given a tour of that New West facility, right?
I don't think they're there for stick and puck.
Yeah,
okay?
No.
So there's that. But I wonder about the location, you know, South Burnaby. As you know, I'm a proud person from North Burnaby.
Yeah.
But that aside, Thomas, you tell me this, and you worked with the Florida Panthers, oftentimes players, and we know this, right?
Yeah.
That they'll live around the area where the practice facility is.
Yep.
And, you know, would that be the case? First things first, get the practice facility and go from there. I'm just not so sure if a lot of players would want to set up shop there. That's all.
Yeah. I think the
I want to give credit. Go ahead.
You shoot.
I want to give credit to Ryan Baines, who was, a big fan of Donnie Dolly, who sent us the pitcher. You know, Rutherford and Alvin. You know, Thomas, I texted you this morning. I don't think they're going to Buffalo at the combine, which
surprised me too. I was under the impression that Alvin was going.
Yeah, and somebody told me this morning that he's not going, which is really interesting, but I'm still trying to confirm that, as you are. But there he is checking out a practice facility this morning. You know, I told Donnie this morning, look at Bill Zito yesterday. Did you hear him raving about he asked the owner for a practice facility and boom, it was done. And he asked the owner for this, it was done. He asked
some
the owner
creative
for this,
license
and
there.
It was done.
That land was acquired about 18 months before Bill Zito was hired. But yes.
No, okay, but...
Nonetheless,
Thomas,
they deserve credit. It's a beautiful facility.
Yeah. When you have a good owner, you know, and when you have an owner that does it year in, year out, why do all the UFAs want to play in Florida? They're doing something right. Mm-hmm. And when an organization is going right, it always starts at the top. 1,000,000%, it starts with a good owner, and then it filters all the way down into the dressing room. There is a reason why everybody wants to sign in Florida. They're doing it right.
Yeah,
Thomas, tell me, when it comes to Florida's practice facility seems to be the gold standard, or at least near the top of the gold standard. Do they share that with the community? Is there a financial investment from a community there? Is there a partnership? What's the situation there?
Yeah, so there was a derelict building called the War Memorial that was sort of like a historic site protected in downtown Fort Lauderdale, right near Las Olas. And in a public partnership sort of with the city of Fort Lauderdale, the Florida Panthers were able to. It's in partnership, Donnie. I believe that they own it outright. But there was significant conditions and a lot of work at community council meetings and on to do it the right way. It's both sort of a Panthers facility and operated for the community. That's one of the benefits of an NHL practice facility, right? Is that an NHL team only actually occupies the ice like 5% of the time, right? So you often have figure skating and youth hockey programs and learn to skate programs that also operate. Like, it's a community asset when you do it right, which the Florida Panthers have. And, you know, they were able to construct that facility while preserving sort of the Art Deco facade and a variety of the things that matter from a, like, historical preservation standpoint, which I think is partly why, you know, it's best in class. So it is a Panthers operated, as I recall. When I was working on it back in the day, it is a Panthers operated and owned facility, but in partnership with the city on a variety of different levels. The thing about the practice facility being out in New West there, or South Burnaby, gentlemen, is the key is you're 30 minutes away from the game rink and where most of the players live, which isn't great. But you're 25 minutes from the airport.
Yes.
And the airport commute at least makes it a practical place to skate.
Very good.
On your way out of town, which is critical. I still feel like you'd probably do morning skates at the rink itself, but at least it's not like much more cumbersome than UBC from the perspective of place you're stopping to get a quick sweat in before you fly. So I think it's right on the fringes of being a workable location for an NHL team facility in this series, but I do think it falls within the parameters of something that could actually be practical for the hockey team.
I actually got an update. It's got two rinks in there, but also multiple purpose rooms with big enough to convert to a gym and upstairs viewing for the fans. There's also an empty lot next to the high school that can be developed on. So it looks like they're there for a reason, guys. It looks like the Canucks toured this place this morning for a reason. And like Donnie said, they're going to partner up with somebody because when you partner up with somebody, you cut the time in half. The owner, if you buy land, you got to work with the city to get the permits. Then it's going to be 5, 6, 7 years. You know what? If you partner up, and Donnie's been saying this, partner up with somebody. This facility, by the way, Rosemary Brown Rec Center, opened up in May of 2024. So, guys, it's pretty new.
Yeah.
It's pretty new.
Yeah. And, Thomas, do you remember, I'm asking you questions, though, you know, we're the ones doing the interview here, but do you remember when the Canucks were at 8 rinks?
I do,
when the Grizzlies were around?
Yeah, way back in the day when they had the sort of like parceled off bit at the back.
And I wonder if
team offices,
they're still there. I wonder if they regret their dressing room replicated what they had at what was GM Place at the time. I thought it was a pretty good setup right in the middle of the Lower Mainland. I wonder if that, looking back, if they don't regret that move or how involved the Aquilinis would have been. I think it would have been near the crossover, the crossover time between owners. But I wonder if they regret that move. And now it looks like maybe they're going back to Burnaby, although a different location.
Yeah, or the False Creek plan falling, the one that Chris Tanev was recruited on as an undrafted free agent back in 2009. Well, I mean, that facility, you know, that would have been amazing. I mean, then Vancouver would have been a true destination. You live in Yale Town, play and practice in False Creek. That would have been nasty. Oof. So I wonder if there's some regrets there too.
Well, if nothing else, this is fantastic publicity for the Rosemary Brown Rec Center, which I was not familiar with.
Two rinks!
I think, and multi-purpose rooms! And it's not that far from the airport.
And multi-purpose rooms. Book your kid's birthday
today.
And
an empty lot.
Empty lot next to the high school. I didn't know this place existed, but
me
I do now.
This is unbelievable. Can I just say something here, guys?
Yeah.
Like the Rosemary Brown is in South Burnaby, which, as Thomas mentioned, is near New West. Rick grew up in the U.S., and again, he proves how little he knows about his hometown. You constantly do that.
It's a new facility. It's a new facility.
This is in Burnaby.
It opened like a year ago.
But it's close to New West, though.
Don't care. Yeah, Columbia Street, 6th Ave, 6th Street, Queens Park, Mugs and Jugs. I know New West.
Yeah, and the Army and Navy, you thought it was still open
in New West.
No, I
thought the Army Navy was open on Columbia Street. It's gone. God bless that place. It was a beautiful
place.
Since
1993.
In the 70s and 80s, that Army Navy was the go-to place in New West.
Maybe the Canucks should go there.
And Woodward's on 6th Street.
They can get their uniforms. They can get their next jerseys from the Army and Navy.
Let's call Derek. Let's talk Derek Forber.
God bless that Army Navy. It's no longer there.
Let's free publicity to Army and Navy. My goodness. Let's talk Derek Forber here. Rick, what did you make of the Canucks signing him for $2 million? And I've got a take on this, so I'll come back to it after I've heard you guys speak. But what do you think about the potential logjam on the back end?
Okay, so they've been trying to sign Forbert for a long time, back as far as the trade deadline. They had a couple of offers for him at the deadline, I was told. They didn't move him, obviously. They love his size, the PK. He would have had some good options on July 1st. He loves the new assistant coach, Kevin Dean. But this is the key for me. Forbert's very good in the room. Adam Foote really wanted him back for that reason. And Rick Tocchet made it very clear before he left, lack of leadership this season. He really was, if he would have stayed, he was going to identify leadership guys on July 1st. I do believe the Canucks have been after Forbert for a long time. Good in the room. Foote didn't want to lose that. He really didn't want to lose that. That's the information I got on Derek Forbert.
I wonder what it means for Elias Pettersson. And I think, guys, you agree with me. Both of you agree with me. And that I just loved one of the few positives of the Canucks season last year. What does this mean for him on that left side? Does it mean that he has to move to the right side, which he did at times fairly effectively last year? I don't think I have a problem with that. But what does it mean? What does this mean for him going forward, although it is only 1 year?
So I'm going to give you my take. You ready? Derek Forbert is the absolute perfect third pair defenseman for the Canucks at this stage of their development, because while he gives them an option and a ton of competition for young players to have to sort of break into the lineup and earn their spots, and he's great on the PK and he does a ton of stuff that young players take some time to learn, he also has only appeared in more than 56 games once in the last 5 years, right? Like, he's good when he's in the lineup, but he's not so available that he's, or so durable that he's like a real roadblock. There's still going to be minutes to go around. And that's sort of one thing that I actually quite like about this fit, because I don't feel like it blocks anybody, especially on a one-year deal, but it certainly provides like a good veteran presence who can help guys develop in some of the old man skills of the game. Not the old man skills, but the veteran skills of the game that, you know, young players very rarely come into the league and are ace penalty killers. I mean, that we don't see that on defense. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I'm all for old man skills in hockey and broadcasting, as you know. Well, with Derek Forbert, I just look at what happened last year: injury issues, but early on, the loss of his father. Yeah. And I think we'd all agree that when he came back, he just got better and better as the season wore on, and you could tell that the Canucks and management, etc., really liked him. I was impressed by him by the end of the year. And their penalty killing, their power play was
good down the stretch,
but their PK was deep.
And let me say this, guys. They identified him. These negotiations didn't start 48 hours ago.
No.
They've been after this guy for a long time. He went from 1.5 to 2. My guess is a few weeks of the Canucks were nowhere near 2, and they bumped it up. One more thing. The left side for me is set with Hughes, Marcus Pettersson, and Forbert. I want to go to the right side. After Hronek and Myers, there's only one spot left for me. That's third pair right side. You're going to have Elias Pettersson, the defenseman, Tom Molander, Victor Mancini, Noah Juulsen, battle that out. Now, hold it on Juulsen. Juulsen's a UFA. He has not been told by the Canucks that he's out. And I'm going to tell you something else about Juulsen. You don't let him go, and you don't tell him he's out, because if the Canucks make a trade for a top six forward or a center, they might have to use one of those young defensemen. And if you trade one of those young defensemen, then you might need Noah Juulsen as a possible 6-7 guy. And so I'm just saying, I know everyone's saying get rid of Juulsen, but if the dynamics show that they're after these top six pieces and it might cost you a young defenseman, I wouldn't be in a rush to get rid of Noah Juulsen right now.
Yeah, they need depth. And we see whether it's Forbort leaving the lineup. Yeah. And of course, part of it was injury last year. Part of it was personal, the personal tragedy of his father passing. But no matter who it is, they always need depth on the blue line, right? And I don't think there was any way they were going to go into the season with, you know, DPD, Volander, Mancini as like 5, 6, and 7 on the depth chart. They were going to bring in veterans to supplement that. And as you say, Rick, You know Forsberg, you know what he brings, you know the leadership qualities he brings on a one-year deal. It makes a ton of sense to bring him back, especially of what he did on the penalty kill last year. Now, I know you've made this point, Rick, as well, that maybe the presence of Kevin Dean, who hasn't been officially announced, but you brought his name up, and then Drance reported yesterday he's going to be an assistant on Adam Foote's staff, if that changed the calculation a little bit for Derek Forsberg. And more Canucks coaching news today, Dave Pignota of the Fourth Period and initially reporting that Yogi Shevkosky going to leave the Canucks and go join Rick Tocchet in Philly. Of course, Yogi was running the power play for the Canucks. He was a skill coach before that. So it's going to be, other than Adam Foote as a holdover from Tocchet's staff, it looks like we're going to have a very different staff with a lot of new faces on the Canucks bench next year.
Yep. Well, I mean, Rick disagrees with me, but how'd their season go this past year? Not all that well, so I don't think this can be considered all that surprising. It's just that, you know, for me, with Yogi, and I can remember him coaching against my son, South Delta Minor Hockey in the Delta Academy, he was so ensconced in the Vancouver community. He probably knew all about Rosemary Brown and that facility long before any of us did. So that it's a little surprising from that point of view, but his relationship with Rick Tocchet talks, I'm sure the Flyers were going to pay him more money than the Canucks were willing to offer, so off he goes. But I'm just a little surprised given how closely he's tied to the Vancouver community, not just at the pro level.
Here's what I was told this morning on Yogi Shevkosky. I'll tell you, the Canucks didn't want to lose him, but he's got a great relationship with Rick Tocchet. Philly reached out. Tocchet loves this guy. All right, I believe Yogi had a clause in his contract where he could leave. Yogi has been, I was told this morning, divesting himself from all his spring and summer local programs for about a month now. So I just got that information. I'm going to dig
into it. Super respected.
Yeah, super respected. One of the best skills guys in the Lower Mainland. I think his spring team were called the Bears or something. They're a really good program. And you know what? He's a great skills guy. Everybody in the Lower Mainland knows Yogi. There are guys in Detroit, NHL players, who would fly him to Detroit to do skills in the summer with a group of guys. Very well respected. I still do believe Canucks did not want to lose this guy. I believe it was, you know, that relationship with Rick Tocchet. Hey, Tocchet's first steal. Tocchet's first steal out of Vancouver.
Yeah.
Who's next?
Besser.
Juleson.
Suter. Juleson.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. So, Tocchet. I tell you, Donnie, I don't think Tocchet's done.
Just more on Yogi. We had Brendan Dillon of the Devils on our show last week, and unsolicited, he brought up summer skates with Yogi.
That's it.
And how much he enjoyed them and how respected he is. So somewhat of a loss for the Vancouver Canucks there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the idea of the Pittsburgh. So you go from Western Pennsylvania to Vancouver and then to Philadelphia on the by way of the Rick Tocchet Steel Express. And there you go. You've got multiple pipelines between the Lower Mainland and the state of Pennsylvania now in the hockey world. Let's be fun to track.
Connor Garland, I'll throw another one. I know he's not a UFA, but we know how much Rick Tocchet likes him as a potential steal least a trade. But I will say on Yogi leaving, and I think everything we hear about him is how well-respected he is and how well-regarded, and so that's totally fair. And I understand why the Canucks wouldn't want to lose him. But to your point, Don, I think watching the power play, even, you know, I know it finished with an okay percentage relative to the rest of the league, but it never felt particularly dangerous. And, you know, throughout Rick Tocchet's tenure here, even as Thomas and I were, you know, carrying water for him on a daily basis, something we questioned was, well, what's going on with the power play, right? Like year one, it was Rick Tocchet himself running it, which isn't usual. And then Yogi came in, but it was kind of, well, Rick Tocchet's going to keep a hand in it. And I think to see them go back to just a more traditional process of let's go get an experienced NHL power play coach who can handle that and take it off the head coach's plate, I think that makes a lot of sense. And so maybe a tough blow to lose Yogi, but I can see the wisdom in going in a different direction as well.
Well, I'm with you too, like in terms of the power play last year. I'm just being reminded that it was 15th overall, and I got some blowback on the show today from our viewers and listeners because I said, boy, it's higher than I expected. And they're like, what are you talking about? It was awful. Well, 15th is higher than I expected. Whoever comes in, their number one job, get the guy making $11.6 million a year to shoot the puck.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, from the right faceoff circle, that would be your – I mean, I know they want more movement and, you know, some more mystique to their power play, but get that guy to shoot the puck. That's number one. Right, Rick?
Oh, yeah. 11.6, Johnny's favorite player.
Shoot the puck, move his feet. By the way, your athletic colleague, Pierre LeBrun, had a good piece today previewing the Stanley Cup final, and Anton Lundell had a quote about what makes the Panthers so dangerous, and he's like, yeah, we all move our feet. There you go. You're right from Anton Lundell.
Rick Tocchet-style player, Anton Lundell.
Rick Tocchet-style player. Okay, another guy I wanted to bring
up.
I was listening to your show earlier today, fellas, and Rick, you made a point of highlighting a player very familiar to hockey fans in the Lower Mainland here, of course, Bowen Byram in Buffalo, RFA with Arbrights. There's been tons of trade speculation around him. He's been connected to the Canucks before. And I understand that management really likes this player. Of course, there's a lot to like, given what's on his resume. But I also look at the left side of their blue line, and we were just going through it. That's the most solid part of the team, right? Hughes, Marcus Pettersson, Forsberg, yeah. DPD is a natural left-side guy. Mm-hmm. So I understand the interest, but it feels like that would have to be part of a bigger deal or a bigger series
Something
of deals
bigger.
If they were going to go out and get Bowen Byram.
Okay, look, lots of teams calling on Bowen Byram. He's an RFA with Arbrights, right? So Arbrights is causing the problem because the agent can take him to UFA status in 2 years. All I was told was lots of teams in the Western Conference are after Bowen Byram. Would not be surprised if the Canucks are one of those teams checking in on Byram. You have to check in when there's 23-year-old defensemen who are top four. I don't care what your left side looks like. Quinn Hughes might leave in 2 years. You know, is Bowen Byram going to be available in 2 years? Probably not. This regime has tried to get him multiple times since they got to Vancouver. This is a 23-year-old defenseman who's won a Stanley Cup at the age of 20. And if you go look at the Cup run, he was a big part of it. So anyways, when a player of this magnitude becomes available, it is upon every team to check in and see what the price is, check in, what's it going to take, all that stuff. It's okay to check in. I'm not saying they're getting Bowen Byram, but I'm telling you, there's a lot of teams in the West, because I don't think Buffalo wants to trade him in the East, but anyways, a lot of teams in the West checking out Bowen Byram.
Yeah, wouldn't that be scary, guys, for a lot of Canuck fans if they acquired Bowen Byram? Because the thinking would automatically be, I don't know what you think of this, guys, but would automatically be, oh, they're just making sure they have, you know, somebody to somewhat replace Quinn Hughes when he goes. It would be a bit frightening.
It's okay to check in on good players. All teams.
Oh, sure. It's just given their needs elsewhere. I understand. Look, if there's a great player available or a player you love available, you're going to check in. But it's not as if they're a finished product up front, right? And you can kind of go chase a luxury on the blue line. Like, they need to spend a lot of time and a lot of resources addressing the forward group. So that's why I wonder. I don't doubt at all that they'd be interested, but I just wonder if that could be either, as you say, well, you know, Quinn Hughes insurance down the road, or part of a bigger series of deals.
Everybody knows Bowen Byram's a good player. One of the reasons teams are checking in is to see what his contract's going to look like. What's it going to what is this guy going to cost you?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is he a $5, $6, $7, $8 million defenseman? It's okay to check in.
No doubt. All right, guys, we'll wrap it up there. Maybe next week we can do this from the multi-purpose room at the Rosemary Brown Rec Center in South Burnaby. We can really do some on-location reporting.
Done deal.
I hear
done
it's a beautiful facility.
Johnny and I are going
facility.
To the Rosemary Brown Rec Center.
We'll wear shorts.
We'll all wear shorts there. All right.
Rick's going to show up and wonder where the fried chicken is.
We already had that joke on the show.
Yeah, we already had
you're way behind us. Half an hour.
As usual, Thomas.
As usual. All right, Thanks, fellas. We'll talk next week. That is Don Taylor and Rick Dhaliwal. They're the co-hosts of Donnie and Dolly on Czech TV, Monday to Friday, 10 to noon, joining us every week here for the crossover.
We already had the chicken joke.
Like Bill Zito said, that was bad chicken. You got to get new chicken.
Right. Got to get good chicken.
Good
jokes.
Chicken.
Yeah, fair enough.
I still don't really know what he was driving at there.
I also like, how many times have you had chicken in your life and been like, that's bad?
Well,
never.
I like chicken, but.
But the thing is like chicken is high floor, low ceiling.
Yeah. But
like,
also, like, if it's undercooked, then it's disgusting.
Oh, sure. But like, so long as it's prepared in an edible fashion.
Yeah.
I very rarely have chicken and I'm like, that's the best chicken. And I very rarely have chicken and think, oh, that was not good chicken.
That's disgusting. Yeah, the only thing is undercooking it.
Yeah. Even like the rubbery stuff you sometimes get in like a pre-made salad at a fast food restaurant, you're like, yeah, that's fine.
That's chicken.
No. If it's overcooked, it's
See, dry. That's the difference. That's the difference between you and Bill Zito. Bill Zito would get that chicken out of there.
And stop adding the sweet onion sauce.
What?
You know how they always have sweet onion sauce on the rubbery chicken?
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
All you right. guys know what I'm talking about, right?
I'm not with you on this one.
Buddy. Wow. Zach, you guys are wow. all have no idea what I'm talking about.
Oh, for three here in the
Take
studio.
The Eldrance.
Okay.
We'll see. We'll see if anyone texts in and support. All right. That's all for the crossover here. We will take a quick break. More on the other side. Canucks coaching stuff, Derek Forbort signing, what it means for the rest of the blue line, Stanley Cup, lots going on here on the rest of the show here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk. You know producer Zach is in the chair when we get the hard rock re-entries on the show. You love to hear it. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec Studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel offers industry-leading heli forklifts and engineered racking solutions. Visit them online at racksteel.com. Well, I've had something go wrong in both Rack Steel reads today.
I was worried for you for a sec.
Disastrous.
Right?
I'm fine.
You don't seem fine.
No, I'm fine. Just my body slowly decaying.
Yeah, it's
getting
sucks.
More and more decrepit every day.
Did I say already the thing where I... So my...
About hating your life?
No, I don't hate my life. I just hate this timeline we're in.
Yes.
I went up to visit my sister in the mountains this weekend, and my brother-in-law's sister's kids were there, who I haven't seen since, 6-7 years. But obviously, they're different people now.
Of course, right? Yeah.
And I was like, oh, hey, it's so good to see you again. And they were like,
who the heck
we
are
don't
you?
Remember you at all. And it had never happened to me. Now, you're a dad, so it probably happens to you a lot. But it doesn't happen to me. And I was just like, I'm just going to walk directly into the ocean and never be seen again. Now, I'm old as dirt.
Really? That did it for you?
I'm going to go out on the ice floes.
That's just what happens with kids. You remember them. They don't remember you.
Yeah, totally. Their minds are not formed. They're not smart like us.
That's right.
But like that doesn't change the fact that I've been, you don't remember me? Well, when you're like a little tyke and you're just like, no, because I'm cool and you're not. That's what you think when you're a kid. You're like, everyone remembers me.
No. It's not, I don't think that's what you think because you're a kid. It's just you literally don't have the memory because it was too long ago.
I'm the center of the universe and you're just some old
I think
fart.
It's the other way. Yeah, exactly. The kids are big leaguing the adults.
100%.
No. They just literally don't have the memory.
No, I know they don't have the memory, but then they're like, and that's because I'm cool.
Why would I know you?
Yeah, why would I? You suck. Like, I'm looking at you. You don't seem to be all that.
I really don't think that's what's going on. But
what do you mean?
That's how you interpreted it.
How do you not think that's what's going on?
I think if anything, when kids don't remember you, they're like intimidated. They're like, who is this person? Why are they talking to me? I don't know them.
No kids are intimidated by adults.
That's 100% not true.
Kids look down on adults.
You can absolutely strike the fear of God into kids.
Well, sure. But then you have to behave in a way that would embarrass you to behave in front of a child.
That's fair. All right. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Send your thoughts in. We touched on it briefly in the crossover, but worth mentioning that just as we signed off yesterday, after yesterday's show, the Canucks re-signed Derek Forbort to a one-year, $2 million deal. And not a big surprise necessarily. I mean, I think we've spent the least time talking of any of the pending UFAs for the Canucks, probably the least time talking about Derek Forbort relative to Brock Besser and even Pugh Suter, of course. And he was also just always going to be the cleanest, easiest fit. And for all of the talk about the strength on the blue line for the Canucks and the depth, the young depth, which is fair, this was still a very clear need. That extra veteran guy, especially considering his work on the penalty kill, which is a major strength of the team, the leadership, all of those things. He just checked so many boxes, and again, it still was very much a need. We spoke when you broke the news of Kevin Dean, right? It's a very different process to introduce one rookie defenseman into your everyday lineup compared to two, right? And having Derek Forbort back means you're only starting the year with one young rookie defenseman, unproven, in your lineup, most likely DPD, but who knows? We'll see how that plays out at training camp in September. The question I have is, what does this mean? Does it create even more leeway for them to potentially move one of those young defensemen? Are they still in the market for another player similar to Derek Forbort? You know, lower cost, but more depth, more veteran depth that helps kind of shore things up and potentially give the young player some breathing room as well.
Yeah, and look, I don't think the truth is that I think the Canucks' willingness to move a defenseman is far more likely to be guided by the need to do so to accomplish what they want to accomplish. You know what I mean? As opposed to like, oh, we've signed Derek Forbort, we're set. Right? Mm-hmm. That's going to be determined based on what's available and how much they have to pay and whether or not one of their young defensemen has to be included,
sure,
for them to get to where they want to go. 14 Canucks defensemen played a game last year, Jamie. 14.
Wow.
10 the year prior, with Cole McWard getting some games. I forgot that, but it happened apparently. You know, this is
started the season, didn't he? I believe so, for them.
Oh my God, 16 in 22-23?
Wow.
No, he was like a November call-up, I think. 13 the year before. So, you know, people are saying, oh yeah, we're set. You know, they've got a logjam on defense. They're going to use a million dudes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they're not even close to set, in my opinion. And so, yeah, I mean, I think we're very, very clearly looking at a team with, you know, not needs, but not such a logjam that this is any sort of like cumbersome thing. You know, honestly, they're more filled up in goal, to be totally honest with you. I mean, mm-hmm. Elias Pettersson doesn't require waivers. Tom Volander will not require waivers. Victor Mancini will not require waivers next year. Oh, Mancini might. I'll have to double check that one. So, anyway, my point being, like, they've got flexibility here still on the back end. They're not sort of in a spot where they're going to need to, like, really put a ton of time or thought into a crunch as they're currently laid out.
It's not a headache.
And, in fact, you probably still want to bring in another, like, at least Christian Wolanin plus level quad A guy,
mm-hmm.
you know, or like a low-end NHL vet in the Alex Biega, Troy Stetcher tier, because you're going to use them.
Well, also, there's also the consideration of it's great to have seven defensemen or eight defensemen that you like, and maybe you're traveling and you're carrying eight, you know, on a regular basis throughout the season, but you also don't want, if it's Tom Volander and Victor Mancini as your seventh and eighth, like, those guys need to play, especially Volander. You know, you're not carrying him to be the scratch in the press box every night on a night-to-night basis. So you need, by definition, if you want both Mancini and Volander getting games on a regular basis and getting minutes, which I think you do if they're both still here, they're going to be in Abbotsford unless they're in the NHL lineup. Mm. And then you need those extra guys that can be on your NHL roster, right? At least one more veteran guy that you can carry as your seventh defenseman, if not two, to be your seventh and eighth defenseman
yeah.
as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think they're so full up by any means on defense that they shouldn't still be adding at least another credible NHL level option this offseason. I also don't think there should be any concern with them trading one of those young guys, one of those, you know, that Mancini, Elias Pettersson, Volander tier. I mean, given their needs up front, you'd be surprised if all of them remained, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Like, that would be the shocker, would it not? Am I out to
I don't
lunch
know,
yet?
Shocker, but it would be a bit surprising.
I'd be shocked.
Fair.
Not that they wouldn't like push other assets in favor of those mm-hmm. three guys, but I'd be shocked. I'll be stunned if we get to training camp and all three of those guys are still on the roster. Just because, how are you getting the multiple top six centermen that you want If you're not touching that sort of
surplus.
Totally
agree. You have the desirable assets and the assets that you're excited about are naturally going to be what other teams are excited about. So again, I wouldn't say shocked, but I think it would be a bit surprising if all three are still here and still in the organization afterwards. I mean, speaking about assets, we'd be shocked if remain in the organization. It came up during the crossover, but the news that potentially neither Jim Rutherford or Patrick Alvin will be going to Buffalo for the NHL Drafts Combine this week. I mean, if you wanted to throw gasoline on they're definitely trading the 15th pick fire. That's one way to do it, certainly. Just have the GM miss the scout at the Combine.
Mancini will be waiver exempt next season. For at least a large portion of the year. Like, he has to hit 70, he's at 31.
So it's not a it's not a training camp decision.
No, there's no hoops you have to jump through. You are not too full. You are not too full at all.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Volander playing 50 games in the American League to start his professional career seems perfectly fine. Desirable, even.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Elias Pettersson looked ready this year. But how many times have we seen, you know, like the best young defenseman I've seen in recent Canucks history who's not Quinn Hughes, because it would have been completely ridiculous to put Quinn Hughes in the American League once he turned pro. But the best non-Quinn Hughes defenseman at a young age that I've ever seen, I swear to God, is Chris Tanev in the 2010-11 Stanley Cup playoffs and down the stretch for that President's Trophy winning team when he played the, 29 games. The next year, we were certain that, like, Tanev-Ballard was going to be the third pair, unless, you know, Ballard, Raymond in a second fetch the Canucks Corey Perry or whatever we were talking about that year. And he played 34 games to open the season with the Chicago Wolves. Like, you know, him and Kevin Connaughton on the same pair. And you know what? It weirdly didn't work despite both being good players, because they were telling Chris Tanev to focus on offense and Kevin Connaughton to focus on defense.
That was a strange choice.
Well, they were just doing the developmental thing, right?
Sure.
Which probably makes sense.
I see. Like, focus on your weak area. Yeah, okay. 100%.
But,
okay.
But, I mean, that could have been a dominant American League pair.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, point being, Chris Tanev went down for half the year. Didn't hurt him. You know, like...
No, not at all.
So, at my point being, don't pencil Volander necessarily into the NHL. I don't think you sweat it if Elias Pettersson doesn't start in the NHL. And I certainly don't think you sweat it if Victor Mancini does.
No.
So it's just, you know, don't take it to the bank. This team still probably should add another NHL caliber defender. Like, far from signaling that this is now such an overflowing surplus, right? Don't underestimate how many of these guys you need.
Mm-hmm.
It has been years since the Canucks used fewer than 10 guys. And we're talking about a logjam at, 9, 10? Like, all these guys are going to play. They're all getting games, man.
Absolutely. And it's also the kind of thing
they used 19 in the pandemic, like, abbreviated season. But I guess that's because they all got COVID.
Yeah. If Volander, 19 is a wild number. If Volander goes down to Abbotsford and is just blowing the doors off.
By the way. There are four teenagers. Okay? There are four teenagers who played in the NHL last year.
Okay.
2005 birth date or later.
Okay.
Four guys.
Okay.
Macklin Celebrini, Will Smith, Connor Bedard, and
who?
Zach Benson.
All right.
He's now had two full seasons in the NHL as a teenager with those other guys.
Mm-hmm.
He also managed actually, like, productive defensive metrics from a play driving at 5-on-5 perspective. Zach Benson might have been the most impactful 5-on-5, certainly defensively, but overall, of those four guys. Okay. Do you know how hard it is to play for the Buffalo Sabres and be -2?
Yes, very hard.
The idea posited by Dastardly Dan and Satyar Shah that Tom Volander would have more trade value is legitimately something we can't allow to pass. People were tagging me in it like, you got owned. It's like, these guys don't know what they're talking about on this. Absolute out to lunch take. Indefensible, not true.
All right. Well, I'm glad we made time for this.
Thank you.
I'm glad we set aside time
for
you to settle the score.
I didn't want to snipe at my colleagues on Twitter. I'd rather do it on the radio.
Why not?
Huh?
Why not? That's what Twitter's for.
No, I don't use Twitter like that
people.
Anymore. I don't use Twitter like that anymore. I don't
anymore.
Spend enough time on the website.
Well,
anymore. I used to use it like that.
An important
when
caveat.
When it was fun.
There. An important caveat. Anymore. All right.
But
anyways,
I just, point, that's an unjustifiable take.
The
I'm
point
sorry.
I was going to make there before the score settling segment was that even if Ollander goes down to the AHL and he's just absolutely blowing the doors off,
which,
it's like, that's
which
a,
he might need to do because he's not Zach Benson.
No, sure. But that's a problem you can solve in season. You know what I mean? Like, okay, you if he demands NHL time by virtue of what he's doing at the AHL level, there are things you can do, whether it's trade, whatever. Yeah, maybe Derek Forbort's on a 1-year deal, right? As you pointed out, maybe he's injured. Maybe you sit him in the press box for a few games, whatever. There are things you can do to get Volander the playing time, the ice time, if he demands it with his play at the AHL. So it's certainly not a problem. And as you said, it's going to come down more to what's the cost for the top six type guys that they are targeting and want to go out and acquire. I did want to mention quickly before we get to Buchla on the other side here, Brock Nelson re-signing in Colorado, 3-year deal worth $7.5 million a season. Probably wasn't a Canucks target, American, all that seemed unlikely to end up in Vancouver. But what it does do is takes a center option off the table, off the market for other center needy teams. And whether that means there's more competition for the trade targets or whatever the case is, the price gets driven up, not directly impacting the Canucks necessarily, but just another in an already thin center market, another option off the table.
Tidy little $1.5 million raise at the age of 33.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations to Brock Nelson. That's awesome. Not exactly a market resetter here, given that we're talking about a relatively consistent 65-point guy with size who represented the USA at the Four Nations tournament.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a pretty favorable deal for the Colorado Avalanche. I think probably spot something of a we have a chance to win a cup discount there.
Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking about it, too. Did you see the Aaron Ekblad quote about playing in...
About, like, how obsessed he is with playing in... In Florida?
Yeah, and they went out and traded for Seth Jones.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you, I'm still looking at that Ekblad valuation as the Ekblad's next contract valuation, where I just feel like he's going to take such a wild haircut, which, you know, easy to do when you're Aaron Ekblad and have a lot of hair,
mm-hmm.
both on your face
mm-hmm.
and on your, you know, it's an hour to cut his hair. But I feel like he's going to be the contract that lands... that flies in the face of sort of the contractual expansion trend line and like really gets the taxation conversation going. But of course, in Ekblad's case, it's just going to be that he loves Fort Lauderdale and loves playing for that team. And that's where he's been his whole career and they're winning and he doesn't want to go at all.
Yeah. He doesn't want to leave the guys that he's competing for Stanley Cups with.
And that's the other, like Saravalli was talking about Frank Saravalli. I don't know where it was, so I can't appropriately credit where he was talking about it, but he was talking about Sam Bennett being a $7.5 million guy himself.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's like, yeah, well, only if he picks his spot.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, he's not, the $10 million valuation is Sam Bennett being like, open bidding, right? But players are willing to leave money on the table to pick their spot if
yep.
they have a strong preference for XYZ reason. So that's what I think is happening here. Sam, this deal doesn't necessarily like change the market, but it also shouldn't be like a sign that it's not going to be as like significant an inflation. As much significant inflationary pressure as we might have expected on UFS.
Well, it's a good point about Brock Nelson too, because if this deal gets done with, you know, Dallas, Florida, Tampa, the immediate reaction from everyone is, oh, tax. No state tax. That's why, you know, he didn't go for all the money he possibly could have. But it's Colorado, right? That doesn't apply. And what you're seeing is that he thinks he has a chance to win there. And players much more than the tax rate, I think, are willing to leave money on the table to go to that type of situation, a situation where they feel really comfortable and think that they have a shot to win as well, which obviously Brock Nelson thinks he does in Colorado. Can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV, Discovery, and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top-rated shows on these popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at Rogers.com. Jason Buchla joins us next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Guests on Sportsnet 650, call in on the hotline powered by Power West Industries. Don't get caught in the dark when it matters most. Visit them at powerwest.ca today. They keep the lights on. And now joining us on the hotline powered by Power West Industries from Sportsnet, former director of amateur scouting in the NHL, he is our guy, Jason Bukla. Books, what's going on, man?
What's up, fellas? How are you today?
We're doing very well. The Canucks brass visited a rec center in Burnaby to potentially look at a practice facility site. So we're all abuzz about that. We got paparazzi-style pictures going around on social media.
Oh, really? Jeez, I've been in the dark all day, so I just thought on the
paparazzi. I think it's only in our very narrow corner of the world that this is a big deal. Don't worry, Books.
I think you've just been living in the dark. We were born into it, Books.
That's great.
So we understand you're on location at the Combine in Buffalo, and I know we've talked to you from this event before, but just give us a sense of kind of what you're looking forward to, what you're expecting to get out of this week in Buffalo.
It's a little bit different this week. It's scaled down in terms of numbers. There's only 90 kids here this week. There's been much more than that in the past. I don't know what the exact number has been, but I do know that there's been teams that have approached around that many interviews, for example. Luckily for me, especially when I work with Dale Tallon, he in 60 was kind of our cap, 55, 60 was the max. So this is an interesting week this week, guys. And the reason is, well, there's lots of reasons, but, partly because of the fact that the draft itself is not going to be an in-person draft. I feel like there's a lot more commiserating going on and a lot more talk behind the scenes, a lot more people here that maybe otherwise might not have been here. So it's got a mini convention type of atmosphere to it that way. In terms of the prospects themselves, you got some guys that just finished, obviously, last weekend at the Memorial Cup and are a little bit banged up, so some of them won't fit in this test. But at the top of the table, it's going to be interesting to see how some of them interact with NHL brass. And it's fascinating to me how some teams approach this. I'm of the frame of mind that I want to make the kid as comfortable as possible and drag his personality out of him to make him feel like the best version of himself in a room full of executives that he's never probably been in an interview before like that. But some of them get beat up a little bit too. So it's an up and down week.
Books, I think I'm settling on Caleb Desnoyers as my guy at the top of the draft. Just the levels of dog there, I think, are a cinch to translate into an impact guy at the NHL level. What are your thoughts on this big center?
My first thought is that, as you know, you are a writer, and I'm just trying to be a writer. And the fact that you just said level of dog, I'm stealing that. I love that. The second thing is...
Well, you're a scout, and I'm just pretending I am. So there we go. We're even, Books.
Fair enough. Desnoyers, I'm on the Desnoyers train too. I really like this player. His trajectory for me and his projection for me at the NHL level is a player that leans close to complete player. I think that he's going to be a guy that you can roll over the boards in all situations, including on the road and key matchups. And he's dynamic offensively, guys. He really is. He's got young Jonathan Huberdeau instincts with the puck on his stick in terms of the way that he dissects his options in the offensive zone. He can look off one player to make a play somewhere else in the zone. I really, really like that. Some kids, they get pigeonholed on the half wall and it's just going to be a cycle or it's just going to be a bump to the point, where this guy, he's kind of scanning everything with his radar and he's got elite offensive hockey sense that way. On top of that, it's the compete that I really, really appreciate as well. He went from basically being, I think it was plus nine or around there to plus 54 this year on a good Moncton team. But he plays the game the right way. And he can play the middle and the wing. And he's going to be about 195 pounds, and he's going to be in the fight. So when you put all of that together on projection, I'm on the Desnoyers train as well. I think that he's a disturber at the top of the draft. I'll put it to you that way.
How would you sort of, you know, we're obviously focused on 15. How would you sort of rate this draft class with sort of two parameters in mind? First of all, how would you sort of look at it outside the like, we know that there's not kind of the like DuPont, McKenna, Celebrini, Bedard at the top of the class. Like we know that. I mean, Schaefer's separated himself, but this is not one of those years where, you know, it's a take it to the bank blue chip future NHLer necessarily. But in terms of the depth of this class, how's that viewed by the talent evaluators that you're talking to in the industry? And what could the implications of that be in terms of the trade value of 15th overall?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of layers to it. So bear with me as I explain this to you guys.
Well, you bared with me as I asked the question, Books.
Yeah. Well, it's such a good, it's just like a Pandora's box, so the question, which is great. So at the top of the table here, you're going to get guys. Schaefer, for me, definitely is separated. And then, you know, you're getting into those names at the Mises, the Denoyers, the Hagans, et cetera, the Frondels. Even Porter Marton, who could be another guy like Beckett Seneca was last year. Somebody might jump on him in the top three because they want that big power body. But when you get into the muddy middle, I call it, which is 15, you're looking at more or less players that have high risk to have a significant ceiling when you pick them, or they have a safety net where you're going to get a 3F or a middle pairing D trending 4, if you will. That's going to be really important to add to your roster and your organization, but they're not going to move the needle as A-class prospects. So this is the wrong year to have a lot of picks, unless somebody has zero picks and they want to try and get something somewhere in the top half of the first or even in the middle of the second round. Because here's the thing, guys, between pick 25 and 50, 45, somewhere around in there, I don't know that there's a lot of difference. So if I have a lot of picks, why am I picking up the phone to accept a deal with one of those teams when I already know that I don't have to give up any assets? I don't have to necessarily move anything in future drafts because I'm probably going to get players that are very similar in ilk. So the Canucks are in, I keep hearing the noise that they're likely going to trade the pick or they're going to attempt to trade the pick, which is sound business. I would exhaust all avenues to get whatever's best for the organization for sure. I just don't know that there's a monstrous appetite to make a big deal in the middle of the first round in this draft class that could help the Canucks a great deal immediately on their NHL roster for sure. Even if they kind of put another one of their prospects in that deal, it's going to be a bit of a stretch for me. So they're in a little bit of a tough spot.
Well, and as part of what makes it tough for the Canucks also, I mean, we saw the report earlier this week that Utah may be willing to float the fourth pick out there, right, for help for a top six forward. And if there's teams higher up the draft, even as high as the top five, who are willing to put those picks on the table, that makes it even tougher sledding for the Canucks to try to move that pick.
Absolutely. And let's not forget when we start talking about Utah, I think fans of the game start to forget some of this. So in the previous drafts, building up to this one, guys, Utah has had an absolute boatload of draft picks. So what they have now is the flexibility to get super aggressive. And on paper, it might look like there's an overpayment somewhere in there. But they've earned that flexibility with all the draft capital and all the assets they built up over time. They actually have too many. They only have 50 contracts, and there's not going to be enough room for all of their kids to get signed to deals, I don't believe. So they have this flexibility where in a draft like this, they might feel like they've got somebody in-house already that might trump that fourth overall slot. So they trade it out. They get top six help in terms of an NHL body. And that's just a trickle-down effect of a lot of picks over time and a lot of flexibility.
We're getting into a real, you know, peak silly season and rumor season here. Does we had some time to kill before the Stanley Cup gets going tonight. And one of the names that popped up this week from a recently eliminated team was Jason Robertson's name potentially being out there, Dallas needing to clear some cap space. Now, I think most of us think of Jason Robertson as a core foundational player there. What was your reaction to hearing that he might be available from Dallas?
Yeah, I was surprised, just like you guys were, I think. I'm still surprised at it. I don't know that I guess that appetite to do something like that, because you need to free up some space or whatever their plan is. I'm shocked at that name being thrown in there. It leads me to believe, similar to what's going on with you guys there with Pettersson, that there could be more to the story than meets the eye. It might not just be money. It might be, you know, the where they feel like he's kind of tracking right now, or where his buy-in is. I don't know any of those things for fact. What I'm trying to tell you, though, is that it's not just about money when you start trading out players like that. There's got to be more to it, in my estimation. Or, you know, you're just getting super aggressive as a management staff and saying, we got to turn over a new leaf and you know, build our roster a little bit differently. And going to the conference finals 2 years in a row, losing to the same team, obviously they have a bad taste in their mouth. They feel like they got to maybe do something a little bit differently as well. So that's a lot to unpack, but boy, there'll be a lineup around the corner for this guy.
Yeah, no kidding.
Not sure who can afford to pay for it, but time will tell.
Another name I wanted to throw at you, Books, is Bowen Byram. Of course, you're in Buffalo right now, and Byram, we've heard in connection with the Canucks in the past. I don't know how much it makes sense right now, but I find him a really fascinating player to try to evaluate, because obviously we remember his junior career where he was dominant here with the Giants, fourth overall pick in 2019, early in his career, plays a really big role in the blue line in the Stanley Cup playoffs for the cup-winning Avalanche team, and then there's injuries and maybe some performance stagnation. Finally gets it together, plays 82 games for Buffalo last year. How would you evaluate this player? Would you be willing to still make a trade and pay him as if he was a future top pairing defenseman? How do you evaluate Bowen Byram at this juncture of his career?
If you're a Stanley Cup contending team, he's like a 2.5 for me. I don't think he's not a Hughes. Like, Hughes is obviously the ultimate one. And then, but I would say this, that he would push somebody like Hronek for sure for that other slot. I thought Bowen Byram had a heck of a year in Buffalo. I really did. You know, he had half a point a game, I believe it was. He played in all situations. He was a plus player there, guys. And he had a little bit of growl to him, too. He had nearly 50 penalty minutes, I believe. So, to be on that Buffalo team and be a plus player, listen, you know what he is. You guys saw him in your back door. He's a fantastic skater. Yeah. He can transport the puck with it on his stick. He can move it and then join it himself too. So he's got a mix of that new breed NHL defenseman, but he's also got a little bit of bite, a little bit more bite than I thought he had to his game. And I really like this compete this year. So I think he's trending up significantly, he said. and it's a situation where I think he could be a top pairing guy in time. I really like him. I like his trajectory right now.
Books, how do you wait as a evaluator, as a consigliere to an NHL general manager when your organization has American League success? The Canucks are in the conference final in the American League in the Calder Cup playoffs here. For the most part, their success has been driven by vets, right? It's been a lot of Sammy Blais and Phil DiGiuseppe, but guys like Artur Shelovs, after a tough season, have bounced back. Victor Mancini, Kirill Kudryavtsev have shown some growth. Like, there's been some positive signs. And there's been guys like Jonathan Lekarimäki, who has sort of seemed surplus to requirements after a really dominant 36-game stint in the American League this year. How do you weight playoff performance in sort of tracking the progress of young organizational prospects?
Yeah, so it's hard. Obviously, first of all, it's hard, the hardest time of year. So the one thing that everybody as a team is gaining, whether you're a vet or you're a Jonathan Lekarimäki or a Mancini, is that experience of going deep on a playoff run. You know, high leverage games, you can't replace those. Those are irreplaceable. You have to be. It's the biggest wish in player development to get these guys in these types of situations as often as possible before they become full-time NHL players. And, you know, we just talked about the Buffalo Sabres. The Americans, Rochester Americans, went on a decent run this year in the American League playoffs. But a lot of their roster players, guys, their young guys, never had a taste in the minors of any type of – they never landed there to begin with for long enough, and they never had any runs. So this, it's good. It's good to learn that process. So – the flip side of it, though, is that I would expect Shelovs to be really good in playoffs. That would have been my expectation going in. He's nearly an NHL goalie. I thought he was. He's had playoff success at the NHL level with the Canucks, and he's had world championship success, don't forget. So he's had those high leverage situations. I had expect him to play like this. And then Mancini, he's telling me something, you know, what it's going to mean when we piece it all together in the fall. I'm not sure. I can't sit here and tell you for sure that I'm going to say these guys are, you know, slotted in to have jobs with the Vancouver Canucks next year. The process is positive, but it's still a mountain to climb. And but you can't take away high leverage, and you can't take away success. And full credit goes to the coaching staff down there. Again, we talked about culture forever here in the last 2 years with the Canucks. They've clearly got something positive going on down there in the American League, and that's good for everybody.
Yeah, no doubt about it. All right, Books, it is game one of the Stanley Cup final tonight in Edmonton. Big picture, what are you excited to watch most in this series?
Well, the first 10 minutes is going to be fascinating to me. I want to see how quickly Edmonton is shot out of a cannon and pushes the pace aggressively here, and how Evander Kane's and you know, some of these other guys are really engaged physically. Pod Colson, guys, hey, listen, it didn't work out in Vancouver, but he's got a role there in Edmonton for what he does, and he's been playing a heavy game there. So having said all that, I'm wondering how it's going to be rope-a-dope a little bit from Florida. You know, like, okay, you know, empty the tank, get that out of your system, and then we're going to morph you into our style of game. Goaltending will be the key, though. I know it's regurgitate this every round, but if Bobrovsky gets off to a really good start here, feeling the puck the way that he's capable, and Skinner continues playing the way he is, then Edmonton has the best chance. But it's going to come down to that right there, the goaltending. And a few guys are nicked up, but it's been a long break. Eh? It feels like it's been forever here. So I'm fascinated. It's going to be a lot of fun. 3 years in a row for the Florida Panthers in the Stanley Cup final, that whole Stanley Cup hangover stuff that we always talk about, it doesn't count for every franchise.
Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, health, with the exception of Zach Hyman, right, it seems like most of the key players here are going to be available and in pretty good condition as well, which isn't always the case at this time of year. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, we always talk about the NHL as a copycat league, right, and then teams looking to emulate whatever the most recent Stanley Cup winning team is. And typically with Florida and their continued success, we've tended to think of that as, you know, big boy physical hockey, getting inside, being willing to take liberties sometimes. And I look at Edmonton, and it's easy to kind of write it off and say, well, you can't copy Edmonton, they have McDavid and Draisaitl. I think there's something to that. But I look at what they've done on their blue line, bringing in Klingberg and Wallman, right, and leaning more on them. And now all of a sudden you have this mobile defense core of guys who can move the puck. And I wonder if they are able to get over the hump and beat Florida this time, if that's going to be one of the key lessons that other teams look at and try to copy going into the offseason.
Yeah, great. Good. That's a really good point by you. And Jake Wallman has been outstanding.
Let's go, Jamie.
He's been the... He's been the glue guy there for them. He really has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's when we were at trade deadline, and I worked with the trade deadline, and we were talked about that trade. Everybody to a man was like, this guy is way underrated, and he's going to be a guy that can really push the needle here for Edmonton. What a great pickup, and it has been for sure. And yeah, possibly. The Klingberg thing's curious because, I mean, a couple of years ago, he couldn't defend his own shadow in the sunshine. And now he's out there and he's doing what he does, but he's also engaged defensively, killing plays. And he's definitely the best version of himself. Good for him. Great for the Oil. Lightning in a bottle a little bit there. But yeah, maybe for sure. I think that it'll speak to the Caps going up. The free agent class isn't fantastic this year. Let's see how much more money people have left in the kitty for waiver pickups, trades at training camp, and then of course more in the bank trending towards the next trade deadline to do these types of things.
Books, it was sort of interesting to me when I look back on it and see some of the prices paid at the deadline. Specifically, you know, you had Brandon Carlo for Minton, a first, and I think a conditional pick. An additional fourth round pick there. You had Luke Shen going for a second and a fourth, right? You had huge prices being paid on, you know, these big defenders, right? Like the big guys, Carson Soucy, the Canucks were able to get a third and he was kind of falling out of favor. Conditional second for Dumoulin. I'm spacing. Vincent Desharnais went for a pick. Positive value trade to the San Jose Sharks. So you saw this sort of market form where some of the big trade pieces were size on the back end. And what's kind of interesting to me about these two Stanley Cup finalists is they zagged, right? You had Walman for Edmonton, and you had Seth Jones for Florida. Now,
yeah,
it's not like Walman and Seth Jones aren't also large human beings, right? Like, it's not like they're 5'10 or anything. Certainly Jones is a bruiser in addition to his mobility. But it feels like the mobility angle played for these teams. Do you draw anything from that? I know that we're always living in this pendulum of speed versus size in the NHL. Do we learn anything from sort of what these two teams did to upgrade their back end mobility and puck moving prior to the playoffs?
Yeah, I think the contradiction, of course, is that their forward groups are kind of not built alike either.
Right.
You know, Florida's got the size and the skill. Like, at the top of Florida's lineup, they play plenty fast on top of being heavy. Like, obviously, the Verhaeghes, Barkov is, like, try chasing him down on open ice. He's gone. So I think that the way that they were so comfortable in the way that they built their forward groups that allowed them to zag on the back end. I think that if you would have seen that they weren't as comfortable, like if Edmonton did not know that Kane was coming back to be healthy, hopefully. I mean, there's some hope there, obviously, still. But there were some things that kind of fell into place where they said, okay, we need to get the puck up ice quicker, and we need to get it going north quicker. And these coaches talk about that a lot, don't they? Like that first pass where, you know, we want to get it, and we want to get up ice as quickly as we can. Yeah, it's curious that they did it. Great strategy. It's worked out for them. And this is where it's going to be interesting the offseason. You know, you guys have touched on it, the copycat of everything. You know, are you going to go to the heavy guy, or are you going to go to the guy that it gets chipped in over his shoulder and he's going to be on it quick? He might not bump anybody, but he moves it out of the zone so fast that you're not in your zone at all. So I don't have an exact answer for you, but I would say that the confidence they had in the makeup of the forward group allowed them to zag.
Books, great stuff, man. Really appreciate it. I know we're really excited to get this series going.
And fun chat, buddy. Like, always a blast to chat with you. I hope you're having a great time at Dinosaur Barbecue.
Listen, I will be going to Parts Unknown tonight, boys. Sometimes it's good to get off the grid if you get my drift.
Yeah, absolutely. Put that phone in airplane mode, Books.
Well, that's not a strength of mine, unfortunately. But
Chippewa won't know what hit him.
Yeah, exactly. I'll look forward to talking to you guys next week. Enjoy the final here.
Hopefully, you've recovered by then, Books.
I'll try and drum up some Vancouver stuff while I'm around here.
Yeah, let's go.
I love it. Absolutely. All right. Thanks, Books. We appreciate it. That is Jason Bukala from Sportsnet and a former director of amateur scouting. And we love chatting with him. He joins us every Wednesday here on the show. Before we go to break, I want to mention a little PWHL Vancouver news. And I was just saying to someone in the inbox, I know we're called Canucks Talk, so we always feel a little restricted. Not restricted. We love talking about the Canucks. But, you know, I would love to be able to incorporate some sort of regular PWHL coverage.
If we were just called Vancouver Sports Talk, it would be 25 minutes on optimal best ball team building strategy. So I think we're lucky that we're Canucks.
We need to be focused. But sometime we're going to break out of that box. And anyways, I just wanted to mention, because of course, expansion draft process is underway. Now we're not
breaking out of your mold. Right. Breaking the mold, Jamie Dodd.
That's what they call me, the bad boy of Vancouver Sports Radio.
The Jayhawk. Always breaking the mold.
You never know what you're going to get with him. It's not the draft process, the expansion draft process. It's the period where you can work out a deal with the players who are left protected. And per Ian Kennedy at the Hockey News, he says PWHL Vancouver has made their first two signings, a pair of defenders from Minnesota who, of course, just won the championship in the PWHL, Claire Thompson and Sophie Jakes. And they were, as somebody pointed out in the inbox, I believe it was Hank the Tank, they were two of the three finalists for Defender of the Year in the PWHL. So PWHL Vancouver, and we've talked about how and heard about how these rules are going to set the teams up well, and you're getting two of the three finalists for the Defender of the Year. That seems to certainly support that theory. Going strong on the back end, on the blue line to start things off, is Vancouver's PWHL team. So there you go. Jakes and Thompson, the first signings, not official yet, but reported by Ian Kennedy at the Hockey News for Vancouver's PWHL team.
They need to get Primorano, man.
Oh, absolutely. It's, unfortunately, not in their control because what, of course. Is she going to be drafted like 2 years next year? I don't know the eligibility rules off the top of my head.
Nor do I.
But when it comes around.
When it comes around.
Move heaven and earth.
It's going to be a minute, but we, you know, Bedard and Celebrini went south, but it would be pretty sick to get the third North Van prodigy of her generation into the PWHL.
That'd be awesome.
In Vancouver. And very excited to watch some games shortly.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. We'll take a break here. We got one more segment left, and we can dive into some of the nitty gritty of the Stanley Cup final. We're looking forward to see when it gets going tonight in Edmonton. Final segment of Canucks Talk next here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance, live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. That's video game rejoiner music. Peak, like, video game boss fight rejoiner music there from producer Zach. Loving it. Keep your texts coming in. 650, 650. By the way, before we dive into the Stanley Cup final talk here, and game one does go tonight between the Oilers and the Panthers, I should also mention game four of Abby's series, the Calder Cup semifinals. Isn't it weird that the Calder Cup goes longer than the Stanley Cup playoffs? Little odd. Anyways, that's tonight at 5 as well. I wanted to mention, it doesn't make sense to me. Like, why would it be that way? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't, you know,
I don't want to talk about it, but it's just weird.
Yeah, I've never thought about it. And you know what?
And probably never will again.
Yeah, and despite you mentioning it, I'm still not really thinking about it.
I still refuse to think about it. I did just want to mention, we were talking with Donnie and Dolly earlier about Jim Rutherford, Patrick Alvin, other representatives of the Canucks visiting the Rosemary Brown Rec Center in Burnaby as a potential practice facility location. I wanted to pass along a tweet from Irfan Ghaffar, who, of course, doing work for Canucks Army now, a longtime Canucks reporter. And Irf says, yes, the Canucks brass was in Burnaby visiting Rosemary Brown Rec Center as a potential practice facility location. South Burnaby, a little far. They were also at Britannia. That's in East Van before that.
Which is the historic Canucks rink,
that's right.
Like in the 80s and stuff. Yeah.
No picks were taken there, though. It's in an area.
No picks.
Yeah. So it didn't happen, right? We didn't get to see if Jim Rutherford was walking, rocking shorts on that occasion. He says it's an area, Britannia, they would love to revitalize, perhaps hinting or referencing to the history they do have in that area. And I think overall the point that Irf's making is just, yeah, they were visiting one, they're visiting lots of different sites. And I mean, we've even heard that from Jim Rutherford, right? Like, hey, we've gone down the road, we've talked to all these different potential partnerships, and we just haven't been able to get anything done. So who knows if there's anything more serious to it than that with the Rosemary Brown one, with the Britannia one, but at the very least, we're seeing the evidence of the ongoing effort and the searching process to try to find a suitable location for this. All right. As mentioned, 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Game one tonight, Edmonton, Florida. You were saying earlier, feels like it could be some of the best, most high-level, most competitive hockey we've seen in the Stanley Cup era, or sorry, in the salary cap era, I should say, in the NHL. And I'll throw this at you. I've been thinking about this series a lot, what to expect, who to pick, all of those things. I just keep coming back to the series being decided by one thing, and it's the Florida forecheck versus Edmonton moving the puck.
Yep.
Is that an unfair?
No.
And no. I don't think that's a bold take. As I referenced the article Pierre LeBrun wrote at The Athletic today, and it was along those lines, getting quotes from all of the relevant parties about that matchup specifically. It just feels like Edmonton has gotten so good at moving the puck out of their end, and Florida is so incredibly good at forcing those turnovers. That is the tactical battle that's going to define this series. I'll go even more granular and more specific rather than just forecheck and puck moving. I think there's one specific play that is going to decide who wins this series. And it is Florida on the forecheck has forced the puck up the wall to the winger. The defenseman is pinching to try to check him. And can that winger get it past the defenseman and into the neutral zone for Connor McDavid to skate onto? Or does Florida keep it in? and force a turnover. I think more even than just the general forecheck thing, I think that play is going to determine what happens in the series.
Yeah, and I think the like one of my keys things to watch for is just the Jake Walman irrational confidence, willing to pass the puck up the middle of the ice. You have to attack the Panthers in the area of the ice where it's most dangerous to do so. We saw the Maple Leafs have success in spring odd man rush after odd man rush, and if the Oilers shooters are going to get that on Bobrovsky, they're going to win this series. Like, if they can reliably get that, especially in tied game states, they're going to have a really nice time of this. And so, or when they're leading, right? Like, they're leading, and if you're able to connect those two passes and spring a two-on-one, like, man, no one does that better than Edmonton. Edmonton's rush game is the best on the planet, and the Panthers' ground-and-pound game is the best on the planet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, their offensive zone possession just, like, grind people down. So, yeah, I think you're right. It's effectively like the league's most explosive pass rush against the league's most explosive pass attack.
Like downfield passing attack?
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's honestly the best analogy for how to think about this series.
Well, it's especially interesting, too, because I as much as I do expect it to be a really close, competitive series, the strengths are such that if you're winning, like if you're Florida and your forecheck is consistently winning that matchup, mm-hmm. as we saw against Carolina, it can get ugly.
Yes.
And conversely, if you're Edmonton and you're consistently beating Florida's forecheck, you can pile up goals. You know what I mean? Like, I could see some crooked score lines in this series because if you win that tactical battle, like, it's not a marginal advantage.
No.
It's a high risk situation for both teams.
I'd add this. I think you could see some crooked score lines across 15 minute stretches both ways.
Yeah.
Like, I think you could see. And in the same game.
Right.
Like, I think you could see a Florida Panthers avalanche for 15 minutes in which they put up two or three, followed by a stretch where Edmonton finds their legs, dissects, you know, the stress game that Paul Maurice will deploy, and comes back in the game mm-hmm. and takes it over. Right. I mean, I think you're going to see swings like that each period. And that's why, like, no one has been in the same class as these teams. Right. This has not been two teams, in my opinion, that have been, like, the biggest test the Oilers got was by an LA Kings team that they ultimately patted on the head quite dismissively,
mm-hmm.
right? The biggest test that the Florida Panthers had, the biggest sweat they've had was from a Maple Leafs team that they absolutely flattened when it mattered in games 5 and 7 of that series. You know, on the road, by the way. No one has been in the same, like, air as these two teams. They're head and shoulders with a cloud cover above where the rest of the league is at. And that level of strength on strength in a matchup, phenomenal. Like, I don't really have a sense of which way it's going to go. I am picking it. Are we going to do predictions? I'm going to pick Edmonton in 7.
Yeah, that's what I was going to choose too.
No, that's okay. I think that's perfectly fair. It's going to be a wildly close series, and we both favor the team with home ice. Like, that's Edmonton in 7 is not like a really strong pick. It's a coin flip. It's like I'm 51% confident that the Oilers are going to win. That's what that means.
Yeah, because I got to say, I have a very strong idea about like what the deciding factors are going to be, but I have very little feel for what direction they're going to go in. And I think ultimately what's pushing me in Edmonton's direction is, so you said the most vulnerable Florida has looked was early in that series against the Leafs. And it feels like that's more sustainable, more of a template that Edmonton can use to make Florida vulnerable than what was happening with them against the Kings in round one, right? Because what was Toronto doing early in that series to put put Florida's backs against the walls? Were they down 3-1 in game 3 of that series, staring a 3-0 deficit? Like, Toronto had them on the ropes, and what they were doing was getting behind them on the forecheck and creating odd man rushes. And Edmonton's just better at that. They're better at doing that than the Leafs are. They have better players, better finishers, better everything to put themselves in a position to do that. So that feels like something that the Leafs put on tape. And I know Paul Maurice talked about, hey, we had to make those adjustments. You know, we figured it out. So they're certainly not unaware of the danger there or the risk. I just think that Edmonton basically is going to be able to do like a souped up version often enough of what the Leafs did to Florida to ultimately have success.
Yeah. I mean, we saw it in that Dallas series. Like, Dallas was the better team from the blue line in. It's just that the other two zones exist.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's truly what it was. I don't know. I mean, I love the way Florida plays, But I think the way that Edmonton warps the very like dynamic of the attacking game off the rush,
mm-hmm.
I think the way that they're able to get loose, I think the fact that they're going to have these moments where like the main thing that Florida does is they pile up these heavy shifts against you. You know what I mean? And it's just like, oh, like we've barely been able to do more than fight the battle with a puck flip into the neutral zone in 5-6 minutes. And then they spend the entire game skating forward and you get worn down and then two or three mistakes and you're dead because they're good enough to capitalize on them.
Well, they are incredible at capitalizing on other teams' mistakes. Like, and they just crush them instantly.
Yes. And it's very difficult to have that level of sustained pressure against Edmonton because at some point McDavid's coming back and saying, enough's enough. You know, like
and taking
some,
the puck and go
as a one man, you know, answer, right? Just like in some ways, like, you know, if when the Panthers play the Canucks, like how much success have the Panthers had against the Canucks the last 2 years? Like, not a lot.
Yeah.
Not a lot because
no.
The Canucks have a one man solution who plays 25 minutes a night. And it's like, oh, you're going to forecheck really hard. Like,
I think it's also
okay.
It's one thing
to be
incredibly aggressive forechecking, and especially as I was saying with the defenseman pinching, when it's, you know, you're worried about Sebastian Aho and Andrei Svechnikov going the other way, right? And those are great players. That is scary. It's a whole other thing when you're worried about Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl going on a 2-on-1 the other way. You know what I mean? So I do think there's, like, if Edmonton is able to punish that early, what kind of mental effect does that have on the Florida Blue Liners stepping up and pinching? Because, like, that's got to be terrifying. You're going to make that play on the wall, and you know Connor McDavid is the forward that you're leaving, and you're trusting your forward to come back and cover him. But, man, if the puck gets past you, it's freaking Connor McDavid going the other way. Like, that's got to be absolutely terrifying for those defenders. So I wonder if Edmonton can kind of punish that early in the series, if it takes a bit of a toll, like a psychic toll, on what Florida's trying to do.
Mm. Yeah. No, and I think it will. Like, I mean, I think the Panthers are robust enough and experienced enough that they're not going to be, like, hit off
their game. They're not going to, like, panic.
No. No.
But it's fine margins, right? They don't have to panic.
Margins.
They just have to be thrown off just ever so slightly and hesitate on a read
and,
one or two times, right?
Not, like, in throughout a game.
No,
they need to for 2-3 shifts.
Yeah,
and that's the game. Like, that's, but you're right, it's going to be fine margins. I just think McDavid and company are going to have enough to get it done this time. I actually think the Panthers were somewhat, you know, fortunate's the wrong word, because they played McDavid to a draw 5-on-5 in the Barkov versus McDavid head-to-head minutes, or at least the Barkov Forsling versus McDavid head-to-head minutes. So that's like, that's pretty significant. That's a pretty significant crimp in Edmonton's game plan and effectively, like, you know, 5-6 clicks off their fastball. And that's a fundamental reason why they won.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when you go back and watch game one and game three in particular of that series that the Florida Panthers won, I think you'll see a lot of really wasteful Edmonton shooting. Bobrovsky on an incredible heater, but also Edmonton shooters not doing nearly enough to lift the puck and test him. Despite having a preponderance of chances. And I think when you go back and watch the Stanley Cup final last year, you'll find that really the Oilers were the better team 5 of 7. Like 5 of 7. And mm-hmm. I'd say it was like on form 5-1-1 across 7 games. Cause I thought game 7 was effectively a draw.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, like Sam Reinhart beat Jeff Skinner off the rush. That was it. So I just sort of look at that and think of that and look at how these teams are different. And, you know, unless this Mikkola Seth Jones pair can continue to absolutely pick their teeth with the opposition 5-on-5, which is absolutely possible. Don't get me wrong.
Yes.
And if this loose terrain in line has legitimately leveled up, then maybe the Panthers are good enough to meaningfully alter that dynamic. But I look at Edmonton and think Edmonton's puck moving from the back end makes them an even more difficult matchup for this Panthers team. And so it's a really fun balancing act to consider and think about just as a thought exercise as we get amped up for this game.
They're replacing, you know, Cody Ceci minutes. And did Desharnais play in that series? Or I think he was benched at that point. It was
buddy.
Broberg, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but anyways, they're replacing some Cody Ceci minutes with, you know, guys who are way better at moving the puck, like Jake Walman and John Klingberg, and that has a big difference. And Sean from North Van texted in, awesome show, guys. Unfortunately, I don't see Edmonton can beat Florida. I feel the Florida physicality will overpower Edmonton. Edmonton's not exactly a bunch of shrinking violets, though, right? Like, they've got some big, tough fellas on that team all over the place.
Desharnais did play 15 minutes in one of the Stanley Cup final games.
All right,
there
you go.
10 minutes in penalties, minus one, baby.
Yeah, that was not his series. That was not the series for Vincent Desharnais.
No.
But I think the point about the Anton Lundell, Luce Durainen, and then Brad Marchand line, that feels like they have to have an exceptional series. Whether it's in minutes where they're in Edmonton and they're out against Connor McDavid, right? Or whatever it is offensively producing in Florida, like they have to be excellent for Florida.
I'll tell you right now, I don't think that the Panthers have a toughness edge.
Fair.
I don't like. You watch Leon Draisaitl dig pucks and use his body proactively to shield the puck and then make an incredibly skilled play. I mean, that is maybe the biggest dog in this series. To be totally honest with you, there's a lot of dogs in this series. This is an entire pound worth of dogs, an entire puppy daycare, but. I mean, there's a real chance because Leon Draisaitl is the other addition for the Oilers in this series when you think about what last year was, right? He left that first game against Vancouver and was never really the same in the playoffs, even though he managed to bring it really only against the Canucks. And then over time, like, I think his form atrophied even further. Like, this is 100% Draisaitl, which the Oilers absolutely did not have in the Stanley Cup final last year. But then you think of Perry, then you think of Kane, you know what I mean? Then you think of Pod Colson, like Pod Colson's played with some nastiness.
Darnell Nurse, man.
Darnell Nurse. No, like, kidding. Yeah. Ekholm.
Yeah.
Ekholm's a nasty piece of business. So I like, you know, it's not disrespect to the Panthers to suggest that I don't think Edmonton's going to be at a toughness disadvantage. I think these teams are both absolutely stone cold, battle hardened. They're masters of the dark arts. They'll take liberties. They won't accept any against them, and they can win a ton of battles in the tough areas of the ice. In fact, I think that's where Edmonton's been at their most dangerous. Like, Bobrovsky's rebound control is something to watch for. If he can't catch basically everything from the perimeter, just watch how Edmonton goes to work on loose change in the slot. Like, they're you know, turning one bad angle shot into three scoring chances, or like two scoring chances and a jam play on a shift. Like, that's what killed the Kings. Darcy Kemper couldn't catch anything. He couldn't see, and then he couldn't catch.
Yeah.
And then the Oilers were first to pucks every time, just digging it out and using those frames. And man, it looks exhausting. That is what's tougher than that?
Well,
like, I'm sorry, what's tougher than that?
Florida's phenomenal at that, though, too.
They
right?
are,
specifically,
but Edmonton's the best in the world right now.
Yeah, the recovery thing,
yeah.
Right? And you see it on the power play most of all, but they do it at even strength as well. But I think that point about the traffic and seeing through the traffic and creating those scramble plays, I mean, that's something that Florida is incredible at.
Yeah.
And a big part of their offensive philosophy is just, hey, throw it at the puck, and we know all of our guys are or throw it at the net, I should say. We know all of our guys are going there, and something crazy is going to happen when they get there.
It is, but that's also where Stuart Skinner is least exploitable.
Yeah.
Right? The in zone, like, that's the other part of this. The way that the Panthers attack sort of suits Stuart Skinner's strengths. Like, stationary attacking situations, he's really good. East-west movement off of the rush. That's what the Panthers have to really prioritize here, I think. And then for Edmonton, it's just don't do what you did in game one and two and three and actually shoot high. That's it.
Yeah.
Like, Bobrovsky's, you know what Bobrovsky has become? And I know I've been harsh on him, but I used to be harsh on this goaltender too. Although I think this goaltender was better in his prime than late stage Bobrovsky. Bobrovsky's prime was actually better than this goaltender, but that was back in Chicago, in Columbus. Like, that's almost a decade.
Sure,
ago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the guy who he reminds me of now is Jonathan Quick.
Okay.
Where it's like, you know, he's going to be just absolutely dialed in the biggest games. His teammates have an endless amount of confidence in him, right? There's never a, like, bad goal that Bobrovsky allows that anyone feels is, like, a thing that's going to snowball.
Yeah, the shoulder slumper.
Yeah, no one's body language changes at all. Everyone thinks he's got this. And by the way, that's, like, half the battle. That's such a big part of the battle in goaltending. He knows, former Ian Clark pupil, he knows how to inspire the confidence of his teammates, and that matters. But More than anything, the reason he reminds me of Jonathan Quick is he's just so dominant down low. Like, just so, so good on down low action. You absolutely have to lift the puck to beat him. But if you do, there are holes there. There are ways to get him. And so I'm really fascinated to see how both these teams try to exploit the opposition's goaltender.
Brandon in Vancouver texts in, Edmonton in five. I think they dummy the Panthers. I'm not going to pick that. I'm sticking with Oilers in seven in a long series. But as I was saying, on an in-game basis, right, it wouldn't surprise me if we see some crooked numbers. It wouldn't necessarily shock me if one team just finds an advantage and exploits it and the other team doesn't have an answer. And that we do end up getting a shorter series.
I would be shocked.
I wouldn't bet on it, but I wouldn't be shocked, right?
I would bet heavily against it.
Like, if Edmonton can just, if Edmonton just handles the forecheck, right? If they have the personnel to do it, it's easy to say, like, adjust, but that's your bread and butter. That's your identity as Florida. You know what I mean? There's only so much you can adjust at this stage of the season. So I'm not betting on it, but like I can see the scenario either way where if we're talking about strength on strength, right? And if it turns out your strength is just better than the other team's strength, like you can't adjust your way out of that, or it's very, very difficult to adjust your way out of that.
Yeah. You know, you're right. You're right. And then obviously for the Oilers, it's just like if we see Cal Pickard in this series, you don't think Edmonton's in trouble. Like Edmonton is so good that I feel like they've kind of regularly gotten away with some of this stuff.
Sure.
Over the years where like, oh, the Edmonton Oilers are down in a hole. And then people are like, what a resilient team, you know? And that, look, they are like, I'm not making fun of it. What did I used to call them? I used to talk about that they were the F around and find out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I used to say about them. They certainly have gotten over that. They've been a far more placid, composed, controlled group. Much more like, have you watched Department Q yet?
No, never even heard of that.
My highest Netflix recommendation right now, by the way, you'll love it. But they're much more like Akram from Department Q.
Sure.
Sick reference by me that I promise you there's like three people listening to the radio who are like, yeah, Akram, so sick. Anyway,
you got it.
They've gotten away with it, but they've gotten away with it against teams that aren't the Florida Panthers. Like, this team is the team against whom the Edmonton Oilers have to be tight enough to avoid that major hiccup that used to dog them so frequently in every single playoff series. Like, Stuart Skinner needs to be able to carry the mail from here on out. They can't afford multiple Pickard starts. They can't afford that, like, will they or won't they? They can't afford the blow up. Like, the margins are going to be too fine in this series for the Oilers to reach into their old bag of tricks.
Game one tonight at 5. Also game 4 of the Calder Cup Western Conference Finals featuring the Abbey Canucks. And I believe that one's going to be on the station at 5 as well. Just before we wrap up, I want to remind you again about the Sportsnet 650 and Jays Care 50-50, which is now live. You could win half the jackpot. The other half supports Challenger Baseball, a program that helps kids of all abilities across BC thrive through sport. Tickets start at just $10. We've got bundles, so you can have even more chances to win. Don't wait. Get your tickets now at jayscaregolf.rafflenexus.com or text money to 650-650 now to get the link sent directly to you. Must be 19 or older and live in BC to play. Let's make a big impact together. That's the show. We'll be back tomorrow for Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.